Addiction impacts all of us. Historically, resources for families of addicts and alcoholics have been few and far between. You're listening to the Voices in Courage podcast with K.L. Wells, where we help these supportive families understand the mind of an addict and transform amidst a loved one's addiction. We share hopeful stories, real conversations, and powerful tools, offering support and solutions to escape the chaos of addiction and shift into a life of thriving. We explore the challenges of isolation, shame, and shattered dreams, and share how to take back control of your life. Subscribe at voicesincourage.com and get access to our exclusive newsletter, blogs, and other transformational resources, and discover a growing community to help you thrive. Thanks for tuning in.
Hello, everyone. So we are back again at Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, and I can't even begin to tell you how excited I am to have Dr. Lynetta Willis with us today. This has been months in the making, and both of our teams on both sides are like, is this going to happen or is this not happening? And so here we are. We are both thrilled to be together today and to share her story with you, which so many people deal with intergenerational trauma and drama. And we generally almost always have an origin story to pull forward. And so I want her to share her origin story with you, but I also want to tee up. This woman is incredibly accomplished, and speaker, author, mom, wife, survivor, thriver, all the things that I think in some ways we've been connected. We just didn't know it. So please, Dr. Lynetta Willis, thank you for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited this is happening. I woke up this morning and I was like, oh, we're actually going to do this.
Really, we are.
Thank you. Right. So thank
Absolutely.
You for having me. This whole topic around intergenerational traumas and dramas and how alcoholism interweaves itself in, it is definitely one that is near and dear to my heart. I, as a psychologist and now a family coach, I work with a lot of families who, especially parents, who want to raise themselves and their children differently than they were raised. Mm-hmm. So I often meet and journey alongside a lot of people who alcoholism was a part of their childhood narrative. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely something that was present in my family. I've actually lost a number of family members to alcoholism and other substance abuse addictions. Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, I'm a trauma survivor, a sexual abuse survivor. So I have a lot of different traumas peppered throughout my history. Mm-hmm. And when I was in college, I was in a relationship, as we tend to do, that reflected, looking back, what it did was this person helped to bring forth from me the insecurities and the baggage and all of the negative core beliefs, mm-hmm. right, that I had mm-hmm. with inside of myself that I had been suppressing.
Right.
Because that's just what I learned to do, right? Like emotions mm-hmm. were a liability in mm-hmm. my family growing up. It wasn't mm-hmm. something that you, things like stop crying before I give you something to cry about. And what's wrong? And suck it up. Those oldie but goodie tunes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. I'm using goodie in parentheses, air quotes. And so in that relationship, I got a front row seat to the parts of me that were extremely wounded.
Yeah.
That relationship was abusive. It was emotionally abusive. It was sexually abusive. It was so abusive. And in order to cope with that, I actually started using alcohol as a way to self-soothe, as a way to feel more connected to myself, which was, of course, a myth, because in reality, mm-hmm. I was more disconnected, right? Because mm-hmm. if I wasn't feeling pain, if I wasn't feeling horrible about myself, if I wasn't feeling that I must be connected to my truest self. No, actually, just the opposite.
Right? Right. Yes.
I was just shoving the emotional children into the basement. That's all I was doing with that.
Yes.
But
that's a great way to put
there it. There when I woke up in the morning.
Yeah. Funny thing about that.
Right?
Yes.
Nobody likes being shoved into a basement, nothing, including emotions. They find it really uncomfortable and they don't right. stay there very long. But college is one of those places where if you have unhealthy behaviors related to substances, It can be extremely normalized in college, especially if you connect with the right people. So looking back, I found myself in situations where I would black out. And what was interesting, I didn't drink alone. It was always social. So I would always say, I don't have a problem because I'm a social drinker. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not the one who goes into my room and sneaks shots or has a water bottle filled with vodka. Right. So I was like, no, it's not a problem because I'm a social drinker. Right. But looking back, I'm like, seriously.
Well, you know, I think it's only in retrospect that we understand the lies that we're telling ourselves.
Yes. 100%. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was in that realm of when I work with, and I would talk to ACOAs. I had two clients, one I saw individually and one in a couple. And I feel like they perfectly created or helped me to see this triangle that often happens within ACOAs. One person described herself as a doormat. Mm. And there was this dad who described himself as he was either domineering or he was distancing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my gosh, that perfectly describes it. Like, we're either doormats, domineering, or distancing. Like, those are the three realms
right.
That really, for me, have captured what we tend to do as ACOAs, how we tend to exist, how we tend to engage ourselves and others. Mm-hmm. And for me, in that relationship, I was definitely the doormat.
Yeah. You know,
and isolating, just, I still remember my friends would come and say, like, hey, can the baby bird come out of the cage to play? Like, and it was like a joke. Mm. But looking back, I'm like, oh, that was really bad. You know, it's literally what they would say. Can the baby bird come out to the cage to play? And I'm just like, oh my gosh, all the signs were there, but I just didn't see them.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And so I can kind of relate to this because I frame things in terms of fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And so I froze. And in my family, it was I blended into the wall as much as I possibly could so I could stay out of the fray. And so I think it's the same thing. I drank in college, but not like you're describing, but I did later on. And then waking up to that as a coping mechanism and realizing, wow, that is just not how I want to do my life. And so what was the moment for you where you kind of had that epiphany where you're like, this is not how I want to do my life, or this isn't working for me?
The first thing was I got out of the relationship. After 2 years, I got out of the relationship, and it really led me to have a really hard look at myself in terms of how did that happen?
Right.
How did I get there? And of course, I did what I'm sure is perfectly normal thing to do. I didn't jump into therapy. I decided to get a PhD and learn my way into healing because, you know, that's really effective and works well. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. But I did. Yeah.
Yes.
I decided to learn my way and say, like, I'm going to learn what was wrong with me, right?
Yeah.
I say that partially in jest because it did help for me to get an intellectual understanding of what was going on. And that actually did help to pull me out because I hadn't got to the point where alcohol was my frenemy. Wasn't at that point where, or I shouldn't say that, my consistent frenemy. It wasn't at that point where I felt that my functioning was so impaired by it, or I was always chasing it, or it was more so something I did when I felt disempowered, sad, those types of things. And when I got out of the relationship and I started to do some self-reflection, alcohol was one of the first things that I said, this isn't healthy. Ironically enough, though, because I was in that doormat space in that relationship, part of my use of alcohol was one way that I gained control because he controlled so much.
Yeah.
And one of the things he would say is, I don't want the person I'm with to drink. And I remember saying, this is the one thing that I'm holding on to. You can't have this. I mean, looking back, I'm like, I couldn't have chosen anything else, but no, but whatever. But that was the thing that I held on to. So part of it was, in a very twisted way, a way for me to maintain a sense of control.
Yeah.
In that. So when I left that relationship and really started doing a lot of self-reflection, I realized this is not healthy. And if I keep going down this road, I can see I know where I'm going to end up. And that, I have to say, is one of the blessings. I talk about blessings and burdens of intergenerational traumas. That's one of the blessings of it. If we use it as the teacher that it can be, then we can look at those who came before us as a kind of like a foreshadow of where we're headed if we stay on certain paths. And I was able to do that. I was able to see like, oh, that's my future right there. If I keep going down this path, I'm going to decline. Thank you. No. Right. And so in those ways, that was also extremely helpful for me to turn around and say, this isn't the kind of person that I want to be for myself, for my then future children. I didn't have children at that time, but it was still a bumpy road and it still wasn't easy. You know, I actually had to create rules for myself
about
drinking and things of that nature.
Right, right. My journey's been that awakening again and again and again. Just takes a little elevation and then awaken, and then another elevation and then awaken. And it's just this recurring unfolding, so to speak. You talk about the inner revolution, and that's really, I think, your story, my story, and so many stories at this point are really about that right now. I mean, I do think that we're at a kind of a delta moment relative to a spiritual revolution, so to speak. And so I'm curious to know from your perspective, okay, you're learning your way into understanding yourself by getting a PhD, which I just totally love because I got a master's degree. And then what? I mean, did you have a sense about like, what was all this going to be in service of?
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that I felt was, I was aware that I did want to have children, right? And I knew enough to know that if things don't change, I'm going to end up passing down the same thought patterns, the same beliefs to my children. I actually had an experience that I talk about often with my sister around hitting, where we were in my grandmother's kitchen, and I have a sister 20 years younger than me. And so at this time, she's maybe like two. And she did something that just made me so angry. And I remember standing at my grandmother's sink and she was sitting at the counter in her high chair. And I turned, and I looked at her and I said, don't make me come over there. I'm so angry. I could smack you right now. And my sister was my heart. Like, I was the cool big sister. I would come home from college and she would just beam. And I just looked at her face, just drop.
Yeah.
And I realized like, I just threatened a 2-year-old.
Right.
Seriously. But I also recognized that my 2-year-old self had heard the same thing. Right. I knew exactly where it came from. And so it was in that moment and little seeding moments throughout that process that I realized, like, I can make a shift. I can make a change. It won't be easy because our nervous systems are wired to seek the familiar.
Yeah.
And seek what we understand and the predictable. But it is possible. And that's what I work with a lot of people on. Like, you can shift these things. You don't have to repeat the same dramas. And I use that word like in terms of a play, right? Like, you're on stage and we kind of like repeat the same acts over and over and over again, generation after generation after generation. You can change those patterns.
Yes.
Change those dramas, write a new script. Not the easiest thing you'll ever do, but definitely worth it.
So speak two or three things that helped you really change the script. Because I'm a big believer in patterns of thought and behavior also. And now we have so much information and research and science around our brains and how they work and learning how to kind of override the system. So I'm super curious from your perspective, what are the like couple things, three things that you would identify as so critically important for you, mission critical for you to change the script?
Yeah. So about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, I sat and I asked myself that question because I've worked, I mean, I've been in this field over 20 years. So I've worked with a lot of people and I've seen transformation happen countless times. And so I sat down and I asked that question, like, what are the core things that have helped me and have helped my clients to really shift out of these unconscious habits and patterns? And yeah, and what I realized was, and little caveat, when I talk about those unconscious habits and patterns, a phrase that I've coined that I use a lot is stable misery.
Yes.
Okay? We find ourselves falling into that pit of stable misery where things are stable, they're familiar, they're predictable, which our brain loves, but we're miserable and we're unhappy and we're unfulfilled.
Yeah. Right?
And especially as ACOAs that I've worked with, and even in my own experience, it's a very common place to end up because the alternative, when you've grown up in a house where your dad was an angry, raging drunk, as my drill sergeant dad, Kyle, described his dad, like the idea of shifting and being different is that could cost you your life. At least that's right. What he told himself when he was younger, right? So
sure. Predictable,
even if it's miserable, I'm still breathing. So it's the stakes are very high. So what I realized was there are actually five areas that if we focus on and we shift the habits and how mm-hmm. we show up in those five areas, we can truly transform how we engage ourselves and how we engage those we love. And the five areas stand for PATHS, P-A-T-H-S. And if you're listening, don't worry about pulling out a piece of paper. Just listen. You can go to healingstablemisery.com and download this, because I know sometimes
Fantastic.
People start talking about stuff they start writing. Download.
Yes. Thanks for that. That's great.
Yes. So the P stands for perspective. Okay. So I'll stick with Kyle. So the first thing we have to change is like our mind. Like we have to get clear on the stories we're telling ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So Kyle's kids literally called him the drill sergeant, up the drill sergeant's home. Right. And Kyle didn't drink. He did not drink. But his dad, mm-hmm. and he came to me with his wife. They came for couples work, and they would literally call him the drill sergeant, right? And it was kind of a joke, but not really. And mm-hmm. we really dialed in. He realized that one of the stories he had in his head from childhood was, I'm out of control, or I can't control anything. And that story, getting clear on the stories, those narratives that we're telling ourselves is so important. Don't get clear on them. They continue to run our lives. I mm-hmm. describe the stories as kind of like we're on a leash and it's like a dog, right? Mm-hmm. And it just mm-hmm. yanks us and pulls us every which way, mm-hmm. right? But when we mm-hmm. get clear, we're able to name. It's like a dog. If you know the dog's name and you're confident, you can call the dog, like, you know, Lassie, sit, whatever, right? So once you get that sense of, oh, that's a core belief that I have. That's a core story I have, right? Then you can start to notice when that part of you is activated and comes up in you. So mm-hmm. that's the first thing. What are the stories mm-hmm. that are coming up? So the one about that anger, or like, so I'm out of control was the story. So he would dominate. He would go and he would just try to control everything in his life. The other piece is the A stands for awareness.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Now, I always say awareness is our superpower, right? So learning to lean into our emotions. Mm-hmm. And that was really, really hard for Kyle, because difficult emotions are a liability. I had another client, call her Sarah, right? Like where she learned to bury her emotions really, really deep, to the point where she was more the doormat. To the point where she would take on other people's emotions, right? She would take responsibility for other people's emotions. She would try to figure out, well, what do you need? Like, I remember she came in and we were figuring out goals. She said, well, what do you think if you had to make your perfect ideal mother, what would she need? And what would her life look like? And I'm looking at her like, are you serious right now?
Really?
Well, she was so mm-hmm. disconnected from her emotions and body sensation. She was mm-hmm. so used to becoming who she needed to be.
Right.
That even in that space, it was completely for her. It was, well, who do you think I should be?
Yeah. And she didn't even understand what she was doing in that moment when she's asking you. Yeah, that she's just externally motivated. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And she was fascinating. Like, oh, this is a great question. Who do I need to become? Tell me and I'll do it. And I'm like, I'm sure you will. You are fantastic at that. Right? But that ends up doing, and what she realized was, in so doing, she was minimizing her needs, actually. And she was such an amazing, loving mother. She really was. But things like she didn't have good boundaries with her kids, and she had such a deep need for approval and acceptance that, yeah, she did feel like a doormat, because if her kids got upset, she would do anything she could to not. Okay, what do you need? Right. And so that was sort of where the tension was coming in with her. So A is like leaning into those difficult feelings, right? And realizing like you don't have to open up the door all the way. You can do it little by little, bit by bit. But our emotions and our body sensations, they are not the enemy. They're just signposts. They give us information into what we need, what's going on in our environment, right? So I often encourage people, just tiny little activities, like find a time in your day when you get, usually in transitions, it's the easiest, like mm-hmm. when you get to work, when you get off from work, before bed, while you're cooking dinner, stop and say like, what am I feeling right now?
Mm-hmm.
What emotion? What body sensation? What do I need right now? And what do I need could be something simple, like I need to pee, I need water, right? Like, it doesn't have to be, I need self-actualization, I need spiritual enlightenment. Like, we don't have to go there. We're talking like Maslow's hierarchy here. Like,
right.
Start at the bottom rung. Basic needs, people.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Starting lean into that. And the third one is T, which stands for tools. Were you going to say something?
No, I actually was thinking, okay, what's T?
Yeah. T stands for tools. And tools, I always say, in a relationship, you're always using them, right? So the question is never, am I using a tool? It's, is this tool helpful or unhelpful? Right. Mm-hmm. So getting clear on what tools are you using in your relationship to survive, right? For Kyle, his tools were domination and distancing. Right? He would either be angry coming at you, or he would pull away and just ignore you. So what tools are you using to get through, right? And that's not in a judgment sense. It's just what tools are most helpful for you.
Right.
Sarah, it was seeking approval. What do you need? Am I okay? Am I okay? Right? Making sure that she was safe and that everyone's needs were met in the environment so that she could be safe.
Right.
So getting clear on what tools are you using? And these are, these tools often, I find, kind of weave into your stable misery pattern, like what pattern you're using to keep you in that stable misery. So figuring that out and then asking yourself, what tools can I experiment with instead? I love the word experiment. It's my favorite word in the English language. And so, because when we look at stuff, it's like, what tools can I shift to? Or how can I shift my mindset? It's sort of like, that's kind of like hard work. It's like, it's like, that's a lot. But if it's like, for today, can I experiment with one new story? If I walked around with a new story, if I walked around with this, you know, playing, experimenting with this new tool, just for bedtime, just for, that feels easier. It feels better.
Yeah, I agree. I love the languaging. That's great.
Yes, yes. So shifting the tools that you use. H stands for healing, and honoring. And I would say you have to heal your triggers and you honor your stressors, right? And your triggers are those things from your past that are impacting your present moment. And this happens a lot in relationships. Whereas a stressor is something going on in your present moment that is impacting how you're showing up. So I didn't eat enough. I didn't get lunch, or I'm overwhelmed at work, things like that. The healing involves figuring out what those things are. And the beautiful thing about stressors and triggers is they kind of flow from the same bucket, meaning some people think, I have to heal everything from my past in order to be a good mom or a good dad, right? And it's like, actually, can you start with just reducing some of your stressors? What are some stressors? Because if we have less stress, you know, if you take a little bit of that edge off, then you have more bandwidth, more capacity to deal with those other things that are going on in your life. You have more capacity to experiment with different tools, to monitor those thoughts, to allow some of those emotions and body sensations to be actualized. Right? So sometimes it's like, start there. And then the S stands for self-empowerment. So I always ask people, like, where do you feel most powerless in your relationship? Especially if you could choose like one, I often say, choose like one experience, right? So like, oh, you know, it was bedtime. We were trying to put the kids to bed and my partner was screaming at me to, I don't know, put the laundry in the dryer, and all these things were happening. And I felt the most powerless in that moment when my kid was screaming at me to stay in the room and my partner was screaming at me to put the laundry. I just wanted to burst, right? Like, I couldn't handle it.
Enough already.
Exactly. So asking yourself, like, where do you feel most powerless in that dynamic? And if we assume, play again with this idea, experiment with the sense that we always have power in a moment. We always have power. It's somewhere. Sometimes it's really hard to see, but it's there. And being able in those moments, especially outside of those, when you can reflect back and prepare for the next time, but asking yourself the key question is like, where is my power when I'm in that place? Where is my power when I'm in that place? Right. And once you can start to identify that, then the drill sergeant and the doormat parts and all those different aspects of you don't need to be, because the reason why those parts of us get actualized and come out is because we feel powerless or we feel in trouble. Like we're in that fight, flight, freeze place, right? Or we're heading towards those places. So then it's like, up, got to turn on the drill sergeant. Up, got to bring out the doormat, you know? And so if we can find our power or find ways to gain some semblance of control for those experiences. Then when we're in those experiences, we can respond versus reacting from those places we know don't work. So we're not constantly pulling on the tools that we are aware are not going to help and are really going to hurt our family and our situation.
Yeah. And so in my own experimenting and evolution of my inner work, I think about when we're little kids, we only have so many choices. We have a little choice box. And when life shows up and we feel like we're in survival mode, we pick something, whether it's anger blending into the wall or whatever that is. And then somewhere in our 30s, generally, we start to kind of realize, oh, those things that I chose when I was a kid don't work anymore. And so what you're speaking to is that kind of realization of, oh, that doesn't work anymore. And I love the way it's like, it's not good, bad, right, wrong. It's what works, what doesn't work.
Yes.
Then it takes the emotional charge away from it and the judgment around it. And so you're more in the, I like how you think about this in terms of experimentation. It's like that observation. You're just kind of observing yourself. And then it's a bit like kind of the Viktor Frankl moments. You're in a situation, pause. The awareness piece, pause, take a breath. And in that pause is where a decision can be made about the next step forward.
So, so true. One of the things that's also in perspective that I didn't mention is vision, right? We often think about visioning as this very woo-woo thing, but there's actually research to support it, right? Like when we create a vision for something we want, our subconscious brain automatically starts putting things together to move us closer to what it is and make choices that moves us closer. So what I often, one of the first things I always encourage people to do is make a vision of how you want to be, whether it be in a relationship or even just in one moment. At bedtime, this is who I want to become. This is who I become. This is what I feel. These are the tools that I use, right? And then when you're in that moment or afterwards, when you reflect back on it, asking yourself, okay, did that tool move me closer to or farther away from my vision?
Yes.
That gives you sort of a benchmark, right? Like a North Star to lean in, like this thing that I'm saying right now to my partner, is this something that's going to move me closer to or further away from ultimately where we want to be, right? So starting to recognize that and using that as like, how helpful is this really going to be in this moment? My husband and I say that a lot, like we'll be having a moment or argument or something. And then eventually one of us will say like, how is that helpful? Or we'll recognize it and be like, that wasn't helpful.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, that's not working.
That did not further us towards what we're ultimately seeking here.
Right.
And I often encourage couples, like when you find yourself, especially in the early moments of arguments, stop and ask, like, what's our end game? Like, where are we ultimately trying to get to in this discussion? And let's keep that in mind, right? And so being able to have something that you're actively moving towards that you can come back and be like, I feel like we're on Mount Everest, but we're trying to get to the corner store down the street. How do we get off Mount Everest to the corner store down the street?
Right. Yeah. So in this space of redesigning ourselves, this is a thought I have about coupling up is I believe that we couple up to work our shit out. That we attract the person that we need to work our shit out with. Now, we don't always get somebody who wants to work their stuff out, which is another choice point. But I would say my own personal journey has been up-leveling each relationship to get to a point where I found the person who would work their stuff out with me and I could work my stuff out with them. And that's kind of a fascinating thing to be able to kind of suspend our patterns of thinking and behavior enough to think about, who do I want to be in intimate, loving relationship? Who do you want to be in an intimate, loving relationship? And I think for our audience and listening to this is, if you have grown up with intergenerational trauma and drama, this gives you another way to think about it, is that you can actually suspend the patterns of thinking and behavior and then rethink and experiment, as you say, which I love that way of framing with, okay, how do I go from this pattern and these patterns of thought and behavior to the ones that I really truly an expression of the best version of who I am.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And I love what you said about being in relationships that may help propel us forward and they help us to grow. Sometimes you get into those, I call like the relationships are like classrooms in college. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're in that favorite class that you love, mm-hmm. you get up, you're excited to go to every week, and it's just the mm-hmm. best thing ever. And then sometimes you get like astrophysics at 5 a.m. in the morning, and you're just like, this sucks. Why did I sign up for this?
Right.
And those tend to be like the earlier, actually, I love astrophysics, but maybe like, I don't know, calculus or something.
Economics.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Anything with an Excel sheet, I'm out. but it's funny, like the relationship I was describing that I was in earlier, the abusive relationship, that was a classroom. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, and I guess I'm just thinking of this because I was talking to a dermatologist recently about how sometimes you put on acne cream and it doesn't clean up your face immediately. Sometimes what it does is it brings all the dirt and the grime and everything to the surface, and it doesn't look pretty, and it looks icky, and it feels uncomfortable. And sometimes, especially early in our life, when we're less aware, those are the types of relationships we get in. The ones that bring out all the dirt and the grime and the ickiness, and they're not pretty, and they don't feel good, and they're itchy, and they're painful, and all of these things. And we look in the mirror, and we're like, ah, right? Like those types of relationships. And there's still room for growth there. Like I realized how much garbage I had just buried. Untrue beliefs, things that were not serving me. They didn't serve me in my relationships. They didn't serve me in how I treated myself. Right. And I think had it not been for that experience, not that I wouldn't have learned those lessons. They just would have been learned in different ways, maybe less painful ways. And they might have taken me a little bit longer to learn. It's kind of like that crash course, that summer, that Maymester course you take in college, where it's like, I'm going to teach you 9 weeks of information in 3 weeks, ready, go. You know? So, that's more of what I was engaged in, you know? And so there's always, always, I had a traumatology professor once say to me, the thing about trauma is, it will always teach you.
Yes.
It will always teach you. The lesson you learn may not feel like it's worth what you paid for it, but you will always learn something if you're willing. Always hung on to that because that is so true. And you can learn and you can grow. And I find with ACOAs, that is so hard because again, the stakes feel so high.
Right.
They feel so high. It's like, okay, yes, I can learn that I need to not take responsibility for everyone's stuff, right? I need to get out of these codependent patterns and stop enabling the way my mom did. And I need to all of these different things. But there's still a part of you that might be saying, no, that means somebody will die. That means that our family secrets will get out and we'll be shamed.
Right.
That means that people get in trouble. Right. Like all of these things are still there. So it might take a little bit longer. That's not bad.
Yeah. You know?
So also realizing that these thoughts that we have and the way that we are, they're not something that should be shamed. They're something that should be explored.
Right.
And understood. Right. Because they're there for a reason and they served a purpose and they were very helpful. Even though they may not feel that, even though they may not need to help us in that way now.
Right. As you're saying this, what I'm thinking about is those moments in my life where I have been dropped to my knees, witnessing my son's arrest was one of those earth-shattering moments in my life. And I came up out of it with getting cracked wide open. And that was really the only way I could have gotten cracked that wide open because I loved him so deeply. And in that moment, getting cracked wide open gave me the gift to be able to explore, to experiment with, to find that next level of myself and do my work. And so I can bless that experience. I can bless his addiction because it led me to my life's work. Well, I don't know any other way that would have kind of gotten my attention more viscerally than that moment.
So, so, so true. It's like that moment in my, in the kitchen with my sister, you know, like that was one of those moments where had that not happened the way that it did, I'm not sure I would have felt pain Right. And the shame, frankly, that I felt mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. moment. And it took that for me to say, wait a minute, something. Mm-hmm. I don't ever want to feel this way again. And I don't ever, ever, ever want to make her or another child mm-hmm. present or in the future feel that way again.
Mm-hmm.
How do I order some of that? Can I? How do I?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think generally my story is at this point, it is in those moments that call us to our higher selves. And so that's the blessing for me that I think about. And I think that, again, is a way to serve us, is to entertain the notion, no matter what's going on in your life, of what are the gifts, opportunities, blessings that are embedded in this moment, even as potentially horrific as it might be.
Yes, definitely a Viktor Frankl moment there too, right? Mm-hmm. Like being able to say, like, how can we find, you know, the message in the mess, right? Like, mm-hmm. where is the opportunity for growth? Where is my power in this place?
Right.
How can I use this so that it doesn't feel wasted, mm-hmm. but that it feels like an opportunity for me to move forward for myself? And also, like, one of the things that my husband and I have agreed to do, we've been talking to our children in age-appropriate ways about alcohol mm-hmm. and addiction. Mm-hmm. Since they were young. They're 11, yeah. almost 15. Oh my gosh, now. But we talk to them about mm-hmm. like, hey, and your thing, and this thing called genetic code. mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. this is how it impacts people. And do you mm-hmm. remember Aunt so-and-so and this part? That's what happened to them. So they understand mm-hmm. about cirrhotic livers. They understand about addiction. They understand mm-hmm. how it can impact. And part of the reason why we do that is because I want them. I mean, I'm not naive. My mm-hmm. kids right now are like, alcohol, bleh, gross. But there might come a time when they're like, sure. cool, right? You know,
right.
and I want them to not scare them, but to mm-hmm. understand that mm-hmm. there is, yes, there could be a very fun reality to alcohol, and there's also a very dark reality to it. And mm-hmm. I need you to understand it so that you're aware and that you can make decisions with that awareness. We were talking right. before we started about, you said secrecy, death, or it's like, it's a killer. I forgot how you said it.
Silence kills.
Yes, silence kills. Exactly. Mm-hmm. One mm-hmm. of the things that I talk about the four horsemen mindset mm-hmm. That we often see. And it's the four horsemen are pain, blame, shame, and avoidance, the way mm-hmm. that I use it. And avoidance, I always say, is like the most insidious horseman, because that's mm-hmm. where the secrecy and the what happens in this house stays in this house. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, mm-hmm. grandpa died of an alcohol addiction or drug overdose, but we're going to say it was cancer
mm-hmm.
and all
yeah.
of these different things. And, you know, it's like that type of stuff. We don't communicate that to our kids. They're not aware of it. Mm-hmm. And then they're more likely to repeat patterns mm-hmm. that we very well could have been like, hey, FYI, not mm-hmm. that it's our fault mm-hmm. if they give us that information. But sometimes information can help. So being able to own and not hold secret right. the things that we know, because out of shame or embarrassment, or just out of the sense that, well, what happens in this house stays in this house. I really don't know why, but that's what I was told. And so we'll just mm-hmm. keep it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If we share that with our children, mm-hmm. then we can set them up to at least have more forethought before they start going down certain paths that maybe we've gone down and they weren't so helpful.
I think one of the major things that's like mission critical, Brené Brown talks about this, is to teach our kids to ask for help.
Mm.
Because alcohol, drugs is the symptom of something that's taken place that we might not want to talk about.
Yeah.
And so if we learn to ask for help from appropriate people, which is kind of learning how to trust well, then that is a massive skill set.
Yes.
I mean, I know that in my own life, I know that in the people that I work with, is their ability to ask for help actually does change their trajectory mm-hmm. and opens a doorway to healing and wholeness that
yeah.
you can't get when you're isolated up.
So true. I'm so glad you said that. One of the things that I truly believe, so my husband and I were both raised with spankings, beatings, corporal punishment, whatever you want to call it. And I remember mm-hmm. when I was pregnant with my son, I realized we had never had that discussion about how we were going to raise them. Mm-hmm. And my husband was like, well, yeah, we're going to use spankings because, you know, I was spanked and I turned out fine. And I was like, oh, you must be planning to have a child with another woman then, because we're not spanking this one. Something
right.
you want to tell me, you know? And so ultimately, we decided that was not how we were going to go, or I guess he was voluntold that that's not how we were going to go. And one of the reasons I said it was, there were times in my life where mm-hmm. I needed an adult. Mm-hmm. I needed an adult. The situation was too big and it was too much. But the first thing I thought was, I can't tell the people in my life that I, who were most salient and closest yeah. to me, because I'll get in trouble. Right. And I said, when my kids get older, if they find themselves in a situation where they can't handle, or they feel scared or in over their head, mm-hmm. I want their first thought to be, where's the phone? I got to call my mom and dad.
Right. Right.
I do not want their first thought to be, oh, dear God, how do I hide this mm-hmm. from my mom and dad? Because I don't yeah. want to get in trouble. And that, yeah. talking about visions, that is an ultimate vision that I hold every mm-hmm. single time. Try to anyway. I'm not perfect at it. But when I mm-hmm. engage them, when I'm talking mm-hmm. to them, when we're talking about consequences, because I'm not saying no consequences, mm-hmm. let them do whatever they want. No, no, we need boundaries and guardrails, 100%. But as we talk about that and we mm-hmm. we play with that and experiment with that in our home, I always keep that in my head. Right. I want to move you closer to a point where you will always think, where's the phone? I got to call my mom and dad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
So being yeah. able to do that is about teaching children to ask for help and to feel safe enough to come to us or other people to ask for help, as opposed to their nervous system immediately going into fight, flight, freeze mode and trying to hide.
Right, right. And it's so interesting to me. We talk about kids. I'm in the world of executive coaching and business consulting. And quite frankly, they're just little children.
Yes.
Housed in a big person's body. And so all the things that we're talking about here absolutely relate to helping my executives and my leaders learn how to feel, learn how to be aware, learn how to ask for help, learn how to be present, learn how to recognize that they have a choice in how they respond to, quote, stress, and to rethink the patterns of thought and behavior and create patterns of thought and behavior that serve them as adults, as parents, as leaders in this world today. And so in so many respects, I think about this, Lynetta, through the lens of adulting and actually teaching people how to be human-centric, love themselves and love others in a way that actually is soul honoring.
Yes, 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 yes. I love that you said that. I had a friend just the other day who, I have this program called Triggered to Transformed that mm-hmm. I work parents through. One of my parents was like, I work in a corporation, like you need to bring this in. Like you, we yeah. all need this, seriously. Mm-hmm. Like this mm-hmm. needs to be mm-hmm. round like zero for us. Because mm-hmm. you're right, it is. I say mm-hmm. the same thing about our government. I'm like, I'm watching TV and I'm like, they're all children. Like I see like these grown men and women as like little babies in like these long ties with these oversized jackets. Mm-hmm. Like it's like, we're mm-hmm. all children. Mm-hmm. Because, and so you're 100% right, especially mm-hmm. when we get into that triggered place. Mm-hmm. We go back to the default. We go mm-hmm. back to what worked on a very like basic level. What right. do we need to survive? In yes. this moment, the lion is hunting. Do we need to get in the cave? Right. Do we need to pull out the spear?
Right.
Do we need to make like a tree? Like what needs to happen in this moment so that yeah. we are not dinner?
Yes, exactly. In so many ways, I think we're at this critical moment in history that really is about us waking up and yeah. us as adults understanding really kind of what's going on, that we're just running patterns of thought and behavior. And at some point we need to wake up and rewire those patterns of thought and behavior that serve us at a higher level. And so we walk through these different doors and windows to make these things happen. But we're, you and I and so many other people are on this path of waking us up.
Yeah. And I love that. One of the things I often say to people is, you nor your child, nor your partner, nor your family are broken. You just have habits that need to be.
Yes. I hate that terminology of broken. People are not broken.
You're not broken.
No.
Use tools and habits. And once you become, and the thing about habits, they're beautiful. They're amazing. They're so important. If mm-hmm. we had to focus and think about every little thing we did before we did it, we wouldn't make it out of bed. Okay. It would mm-hmm. be like 5 o'clock mm-hmm. before we got mm-hmm. our first foot on the ground. So mm-hmm. being able to, our body and our brain, which are amazing things, being yes. able just to automatically do things are mm-hmm. great, beautiful. We need mm-hmm. that. And mm-hmm. to your point, we also have a need to become aware of those habits and those behaviors that aren't so helpful. Where do we tend to go immediately?
Right.
And I do believe that we come here, like it's our soul's work to come here and to play. I think this is like a big playground. Like we die, we're going to go back to wherever. We're going to be like, oh my God. Ah, God, it was a playground. Ah, man, those were swings. That was a slide, you know?
Right. Yes. Yeah. I love your humor about this too, is because in the world that we're living in, things seem to be so serious and dire, and we're kind of steeped in that right now. And so having people talk about that, these are moments that are kind of the chrysalis moments. And we all need chrysalis moments. We all need those diamond moments where the pressure gets so intense and we're trying to get out of the chrysalis. And the struggle is the revelation of the butterfly. And I think in so many ways, I think about that in my own life. And I think about those metaphors as you've been telling your story too. So I realize we're coming up against our time. I think we could probably do this for at least another hour or so, not a problem. So what I'd like to do is just say, I would love to continue this conversation with you. I would rather not wait like 4 or 5 or 6 months again. So, but I do think this is super rich and I so appreciate your energy and the vibrance that you bring to the table. We're different generations and all the things, but we're still speaking the same language.
Oh yeah.
So how do people get a hold of you if they want to reach out and touch your energy and your wisdom?
So the best place to go is to go ahead and jump on my email list, grab the Paths Roadmap that I outlined for you today. It's called healingstablemisery.com. So you can go there and grab that and you'll get an email and then you can reply or whatever to that and let me know how you're doing. The other thing is you go to mytriggerscore.com. This is for the parents in the room. If you go to mytriggerscore.com, there's actually a quiz there that helps you figure out what your parenting type is and who you tend to become during those triggered moments. So it goes back to that. What are the habits we have? How do we become more aware of who we are so that we can shift that, right? And we can experiment and play with different ways of being. So if you go to that website, you can also take that quiz. So healingstablemisery.com and mytriggerscore.com are the two areas that I would suggest people go to grab me.
Fantastic. Well, I just want to say deep, deep, deep gratitude for who you are in the world and the work that you're doing. And thank you for joining me today. And our audience is going to, well, I mean, they've just reaped the benefits of our time together. So
I know. So good.
Yes, absolutely. You're very welcome. Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. If you're looking for help to go from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos with the right tools and resources, subscribe at voicesencourage.com. We encourage you to share with friends and family going through similar situations so we can continue to build a strong community of hope and possibility. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.